Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Illinois Power Agency, I'd like to welcome you to today's virtual workshop. This is for the index REC procurement. My name is Benjamin Chi. I'm with NERA Economic Consulting as the IPA's procurement administrator. Joining me and presenting today on today's workshop is Director Anthony Starr from the Illinois Power Agency, as well as Ms. Katie Lundy, also with NERA. This index REC procurement event, also known as the subsequent forward procurement event for utility scale index REC for utility scale wind projects, utility scale solar projects, and brownfield site photovoltaic projects, is the procurement event of today's discussion. And these procurement of RECs for the IPA's portfolio of Ameren Illinois Company, Commonwealth Edison Company, and Mid-American Energy Company. Those are the utility buyers of the RECs. Their logos are provided at the bottom of this slide. So a couple of housekeeping items as we proceed on today's workshop. So we will have this workshop be recorded and posted to the website after this workshop presentation. The workshop itself has about 60 slides. We have planned about 2 hours to 3 hours for this workshop to be held to present the materials as well as to get some of the feedback from you and answer your questions. The workshop itself will pause at 2 points in time. We will cover the first half of this workshop on contract elements and a second portion on the procurement requirements. So the first part on the contract section, once it is over, we will pause and take questions at the time to make sure that you have a good understanding of what has been presented before we proceed on to the latter half of this presentation. And then we will pause again at the end of the presentation for a discussion of the procurement items as well as to take your questions. You can provide your comments on any elements or aspects of the forward procurement, whether we have discussed it here or you have seen it in the documents themselves. We have identified several items for discussion along the way, and you can find those items marked with this arrow sign throughout the slides. And to ask your questions, we will ask that you raise your hands to do so, and we will stop at those discussion point in time to unmute you so that you can speak through the microphone on your laptop or through the phone. You can also ask your questions via the chat function at the bottom of your screen if you do not have a workable mic. But we do ask that you keep yourself on mute. If you're not on mute already, you should have joined on mute until we unmute you. But if you're not speaking, definitely put yourself on mute. And one other housekeeping items related to these the discussions on this workshop is that you do not need to identify your affiliation or your company as we unmute you. You can simply ask your question. But we will, for purposes of unmuting you, identify you by your first name and last initial so that you know and get the cue of when you can start speaking. So as I have stated earlier, this workshop itself is being recorded, and the recording will be posted to the procurement website after this workshop. And we have posted prior to this workshop the draft index REC contract as well as the draft index REC RFP rules. These are draft documents, and any statements that we make that describe or refer to these draft documents, they are just summaries only, and they are qualified in their entirety by our reference to these draft documents. When they become final and available, we will post them on the website, and these final versions of the rules and the contract will be the governing documents. All bidders will bear the full responsibility for reviewing and understanding the written final agreements and documents at that point in time. So with that, I will turn over to Mr. Anthony Starr to provide us the regulatory background for today's agenda. Mr. Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chi. So I'm Anthony Starr. I'm the director of the Illinois Power Agency, and thank you, everybody, for joining today's workshop. The background and context for why we are here today discussing this procurement, I suspect, is well known to the participants today. Public Act 102-0662, more commonly known as the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act, was CEJA, took effect in September of last year and gave the IPA 240 days to conduct what are subsequent four procurements for renewable energy credits from utility scale wind, solar, and brownfield site projects. What's unusual about this procurement is that normally the work the IPA does is governed through our long-term renewable resources procurement plans. That's where we set out the structure of how we do things, procurement targets, schedules, et cetera. At times, the General Assembly has asked the agency to do procurements outside of that regular planning process, in part because when the law changes and we have to update the plan, that takes a certain amount of time, and there's a desire to move things forward to get the Illinois RPS back on track. As many of you know, due to some of the funding constraints that were addressed through CEJA, it constrained our ability to do procurements for a while. There also were structural issues for utility scale around projects around a fixed REC price model. So while we are in the process of updating the long-term plan, we released a draft of it in January for public comment. This procurement process is taking place with an arc from September through the procurement in May. And this is sort of an interim procurement. And as a result of that, some of the things that you'll see discussed are things that we've had to work through certain policy decisions on how to structure the procurement and its requirements absent a long-term renewable resources procurement plan that's been approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission. One of the key changes that CEJA gave us for procurements for utility scale and brownfield projects is the shift to the indexed REC procurement model. So a lot of the procurement, a lot of the process will look very similar to previous large-scale procurements we've done, but a key change will be this shift to the indexed REC price, which will be described in much more detail later in the procurement, where the price of the REC is not going to be fixed, but will vary over time based upon energy market conditions. Next slide, please. The quantities that we're procuring today are described in the slide. If you want more information on these numbers and how they were derived, the procurement administrator, NERA, put out an announcement on January, I believe it was 13th. Let me double check that date. Yes, January 13th, describing the calculations. There's a goal in the act that we're supposed to be working towards meeting 10 million RECs delivered annually by the end of the 2021 delivery year. That's obviously since passed, but that is the goal of how we're beginning to ramp up both these procurements as well as the reopening of the adjustable block program to get us back on track for our REC targets. These are also interim goals. The long-term plan that is out for public comment now, which we'll be then revising and filing for the Commerce Commission for approval, will get approved in July of this year. And that will set forth the structure for future procurements and future structures. There's a number of aspects of procurements that don't kick in quite yet that will be considered in the future. But we are definitely hoping that to the extent possible, what we've developed for the procurement that will take place in May will be sort of the underpinnings of future procurements for utility scale and brownfield site projects. So that's a little bit of a quick background on why we're here today and the goals that we have. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Mr. Chi.
Thank you, Mr. Starr, for that overview and introduction to why we're here today. For the rest of this presentation, I'll just very quickly go over an overview of the procurement here and where you can find information before I dive right in into the contract terms. So there are a couple of things you should know. The information can be found generally on the IPA's website But more specifically, the central source of information for this procurement event really should be the procurement website. I've provided the URL of both websites here. The procurement website is the one on the left. The address and the URL is ipa-energyrfp.com. You can find the IPA's long-term renewable resources procurement plan on the IPA's website, which is the one on the right. So back to the one on the left, the procurement website, where you should look for information is under the index. If you look on the left navigation bar, you should be able to find something called the index wind and solar and brownfield link. If you click on that, right below that, you should find several sublinks, but one of them will be draft documents. And under the draft documents is sort of where you will find the documents that have been posted for review. After this workshop, this presentation and the audio recording will also be posted to that draft documents page. So a couple of highlights to start us off. So this procurement event has a bid date that is scheduled on May 6th. Preceding that, the first material deadline that you have to hit is the part one proposal due date, April 6th. So we have about a month from April 6th to the bid date of May 6th to conduct this procurement event. We will go over the later part of this presentation, what the part one requirements, and as the name suggests, there is a part two to this, and we will go over those requirements there as well. So this index rec procurement event is to procure index recs from projects that are selected through the RFP. Couple of things to note very quickly. We're not buying your projects. We're just buying the recs that come out from your projects, and we're going to pay you based on an index rec basis, and we'll explain what that means. It's a comparison between an index rec price and the strike price that you will name in this procurement event. The recs that we procure or that are awarded for the winning projects are then allocated to the three Illinois utilities buyers of Ameren Illinois Company, or AIC in short, Commonwealth Edison Company, or ComEd in short, as well as Mid-American Energy Company, or MEC in short. And the bids will include several elements that we provide here, but before that, there is as the name suggests, index rec procurement. What it means is that there's going to be a price that is tied to some index trading hub. And here, I want to flag up front for you that the two options that you have is either the PJM Northern Illinois Hub or the MISO Illinois Trading Hub. So those are the two hubs that you will have to select as a bidder in this procurement event that will then subsequently have an impact on how the rec price will be calculated for purposes of payment. The bids that we get from you on May 6th will have some of these elements. You will have to name a strike price denominated in dollar per megawatt hour basis. That will be for both energy and recs. And then you will name also a quantity, which is a annual quantity of RECs that you're committed to deliver. And with the annual quantity, you will also be allowed to name a minimum quantity that is different from the annual quantity. And the minimum quantity is an annual minimum number of RECs that you're willing to accept if we can only award you partially, but not fully, for your project. Once the bids are received, then we will evaluate all bids on a price-only basis. But importantly, we want to flag up front for you here that the bids will be evaluated separately for each category of the project. So we'll have one bid evaluation for the wind projects, and a separate evaluation for utility scale solar, as well as for the brownfield under a separate evaluation. So for each of these categories, you must meet the definitions as they are defined under the IPA Act. So these utility scale projects have a new cutoff at 5 megawatts under the CEJA that was passed in September. So under the new law, all utility scale projects are above five megawatts. For utility scale solar and wind, but there is no such constraint for brownfield site photovoltaic projects. The projects must be new, and new is defined by law as anything that is energized after June 1st, 2017. So the date of first operation of these projects as recorded by GADS or MRETS has to be after June 1st, 2017. These projects must not be a generating unit whose costs are being recovered through rates regulated by Illinois or any other state. In terms of location, you must show site control as one of the project requirements in the RFP. And for utility scale projects, this is for solar and wind, they must be located in Illinois, or if they're not in Illinois, they must be located in a state that is adjacent to Illinois that meets specific public interest criteria. And all brownfield projects must be located in Illinois. The site of your project will be described by you in your proposal and will be provided or inserted in the contracts as well to show us where the projects are being located. So, in terms of the high-level calendar, I've already talked about when the Part 1 proposal and the bid date will occur. Before that, we have to finalize the RFP documents as well as the final agreement. This process actually started back in December when we came up with the preliminary proposal requirements as well as the draft contract terms. A term sheet was posted on December 6th. For which we have received your comments on the 17th of December before the holidays. And we have posted the comments on our website as well. You can find all those comments on the draft documents page. And at that point, what we have again provided only are the preliminary proposal requirements as well as a term sheet. As of January 20th, we have posted the first draft of the contract, as well as on the 20th, on that same day, the RFP rules, RFP rules. And then additional documents were posted on the 24th with some information on the comment process for the draft rules. We're having this workshop today. And your comments, the first round of the contract comments, as well as the draft rules, are due on the 9th. So this coming Wednesday, we will evaluate your comments, and then we will iterate a second version of the contract at that point. That is scheduled at this time to be released on February 23rd. And your comments will be due by March the 8th. We are hoping to finalize the RFP documents as well as the contract itself by March 18. That will give us time, sufficient time before we head into the solicitation proper to get your Part 1 proposal. So just keep note of these high-level timeline that is provided here. The big takeaway is that we have had some comments received based on some term sheet and preliminary documents previously. You can find the comments posted on the website, and we have allocated 2 rounds of comments to get your comments on the contract before we finalize them in March 18. So this is a screenshot of the RFP website. You'll find the documents again. If you look on the left navigation bar, index, wind, solar, and brownfield, link, click on that, go into the draft documents tab. The draft documents are dated January 20th, and you can find the comment process documents on how you submit your comments to us in that same on that same page. So a couple of highlights on draft documents. We want to make sure that we summarize some of the very important and key terms here. So first thing first, there are some requirements that are provided in Public Act 1020662, also known colloquially by us as the CEJA. So the Public Act itself has some prescribed terms that guide us in terms of what the requirements must be included in the procurement event. And we have taken those as given, and we have also adapted other commercial terms based on the comments and feedback that we have received from you on the preliminary proposal requirements and the term sheet. Since the time we have released the preliminary proposal requirements and term sheet in December, here are the key elements, not all of them. This list is not comprehensive on this slide 14, but has at least some of the main ones so that you are aware of what they are. So the first thing is the forward price curve. There is some mention of the forward price curve that is being developed for purposes of this procurement event that will become a payment cap. So for avoidance of doubt, we have incorrectly stated that in December. We have reviewed the comments and have reviewed the Public Act as well. And for avoidance of doubt, the forward price curve will be used and established for budget planning purposes only, for RPS purposes. So this will not establish an annual payment cap for REC purchases for this index REC procurement. So it's not a direct annual payment cap to be applied to REC purchases, but that is only for RPS planning purposes. So that's the first takeaway. We have received some comments on that. We just want to make sure that that is communicated clearly through this workshop and subsequent communications. A few other things that are there. We have fleshed out some details surrounding when the first REC delivery must occur. The first REC delivery must occur by May 31st, 2025 under the utility contracts. And this can be extended to May 31st, 2027 with a no questions asked increased collateral requirement that can be posted by seller to extend this deadline. There are also requirements related to the Project Labor Agreements Act as well as the Prevailing Wage Act. These have been fleshed out for you in the contract. We have also been clearer now about what the bid and performance assurance amounts would be, and provided more requirements related to qualifying a project that is located on a permanently closed coal mine. So here are some of the updates here. We'll go into detail. I know some of you have questions at this time, but allow us to go through some of the information in this presentation, and we'll take questions first on the REC contract before we dive in into the program requirements. So in terms of the REC contract, this REC contract is fairly similar to the REC contract that you have seen in the utility scale wind procurement that was previously issued in 2021. So it will contain 15 articles, and I'll just flag a few items here for you. The main meat and potatoes of this would be in Article 2, dealing with the product as well as the project requirements. We have Article 4, dealing with what are your delivery obligations and the delivery year requirements. we have Article 5 that relates to payment and invoicing requirements. Article 6 related to some of the reporting requirements that you have to adhere to under the term of the contract. And Article 7 related to performance assurance requirements and the credit and collateral requirements. We also have a couple of exhibits, and I will break down a few of the key ones for you. Exhibit A is just the form of the product order, sometimes known as a transaction confirmation. That product order is where you will find the transaction details, including the annual quantity that you're committed to and the price, the strike price that you're committed to, as well as the applicability of other elections that are there. You can take a look at what is listed in Exhibit A for information. Exhibit B is where you fill out your information and specifically the contact information for how we will send notices to you under the terms of the contract. The rest of the other exhibits relates to templates that you can use for the letters of credit or guarantee in Exhibit B, as well as some examples in Exhibit F. So I'll talk about project and product requirements very quickly here. So a few basics on this slide 18. So the agreement, first of all, is between you as the seller and buyer, which is either Ameren Illinois, ComEd, or Mid-American Energy. And there will be at least three contracts that could be signed when you win RECs or awarded RECs to supply to the utilities. The annual quantity will subsequently be allocated to each of these three companies. So just take note that the when you enter into this procurement process, you must be willing to sign the agreement with each of these three companies. They are the same contract to be used. The language is the same, the terms are the same, the counterparty will be different. And once information is entered into each of these distinct and separate contracts, the contracts will then be administered separately by each of these companies. The payments are for delivered RECs only. If you don't deliver the RECs, we don't have a quantity to count the payment towards. And the delivery term will be for a 20-year delivery term for this REC delivery contract. More specifically, the product requirements are listed here on slide 19. We're looking for standard RECs to be delivered that will include all environmental attributes. This will be for projects selected through the RFP. We do not allow for replacement RECs from other projects. And the RECs that are generated from your projects must be transferred to the buyer's GATS or MRETS account for them to retire them. The product itself is regulatorily continuing. That means that the RECs that are received by buyer must allow buyer to comply with the Illinois RPS. And the first REC must be received by no later than May 31st, 2025, with an ability for you to extend that through May 31st, 2027. One other point to note here is that the RECs, when we talk about what is acceptable for delivery and payment, we are going to base the RECs not on when it is delivered, on when the energy underlying the REC is being generated. So the vintage of the RECs, what will determine whether the REC is eligible for payment or not. The earliest vintage that we will accept under the contract will be based on energy production of June 1st, 2022 onwards. So that is what we will set as the earliest date for which REC vintage can be allowed. There is a term in the contracts known as the acceptable vintage period. So take note of that. Your delivery obligations will be tied to that vintage, acceptable vintage period. So other things to take note of, the labor-related requirements, there are two of them in particular. One has to do with the Prevailing Wage Act, and the other has to do with the project labor agreements. We'll go through them. The first thing to note is that all solar projects under the law must be installed by qualified persons. And in terms of the Prevailing Wage Act requirements, that will apply to any construction activities that take place on or after September 15, 2021, which is the date when the seizure was enacted. So if the construction activities began on or after September 15th, then prior to construction, you must enter into a project labor agreement. And we'll talk about this a little bit more later on. But this is just a pre-hire collective bargaining agreement that covers the terms and conditions of employment for the specific construction activities. So again, there are three main requirements here. One is just that if it is a solar-related project, whether it's utility scale or brownfield, it must be installed by qualified persons. And for any construction activities that occur on or after September 15, 2021, there are Prevailing Wage Act requirements as well as project labor agreements that will apply. So for how your awarded quantities are translated into the allocated quantities in the utility contracts, this is a slide that explains it. So the annual quantity for each contract will reflect the portion of the RFP awarded annual quantity. The RFP awarded annual quantity is what you will bid into the procurement process, and the annual quantity that is listed in the contract is just that portion allocated to that utility contract. And hence, after that point in time, once the annual quantity is inserted into the utility contract, that is the obligation under that contract. And again, the contracts are administered not jointly, but separately by each utility. The maximum contract quantity under the contract is simply the annual quantity under the contract times 20 years. And here we have an illustrative example. If you win 8,000 RECs annually with a strike price of $30 per megawatt hour, this is all within the RFP process, we will allocate your 8,000 RECs, the RFP awarded annual quantity, into the contract annual quantity. And the strike price that you name, in this case $30 per megawatt hour, will be the same strike price that you will see across all three contracts. So on the right side, you will see two quantities listed. One is the RFP awarded quantity, and in this case, it is a sample for the Comet contract we have allocated an annual quantity of 5,796 RECs, which is less than the 8,000 of the total RFP awarded quantity. And the maximum contract quantity is just 20 times the annual quantity awarded to the Comet contract in this case. Strike price is the same, and you'll have also other elections there to indicate, for example, whether you're using GATS or MRETS as a tracking system, and whether you're using the NIHUB at PJM or the MISO Illinois Trading Hub as your index price for the trading hub. Over onto the next slide here, we have one thing to note on the tracking system, which is that we will use the standing order to execute transfers under the contract. You can make use of either GATS or MRETS. They work almost the same way. You have to establish a standing order. You get to select whether you want to go with GATS or MRETS, and you have to register your project with one of these two tracking platforms. once it is initiated, the standing order will provide for the automatic recurring transfer of RECs from the selected projects once it is energized. You will initiate the standing order within 30 days of the project's date of first interconnection approval. And if the project has already been energized and is operational and registered with GETS or NREPs, you have to set up the standing order by June 1st, 2022. So for the standing order, we'll note one thing for you here, which is that the standing order will ask you to name an acceptable vintage period, and we will pay close attention to what that vintage period would be, but it will be set up in such a way where it will allow for a 20-year acceptable vintage period with an extra stop month to account for anything that may occur in a partial month. So all in all, there will be 241 months of acceptable vintage period that when it's set up in the standing order, it's what it will show. And to account for any suspension periods that may occur during the contract term, buyer and seller will work together under the contract terms to either remove or to resume any standing order. In terms of the credit requirements, the credit requirements are different for wind as well and for solar projects. So for the wind projects, the requirement is $4 times the annual quantity under the contract subject to a $20,000 minimum. And there is something known as an increased collateral requirement for you to extend your first delivery deadline from May 31st, 2025 to May 31st, 2027. And the increased collateral requirement under the contract would be twice of that, $8 per annual quantity under the contract subject to a minimum of $40,000. For utility scale solar projects as well as brownfield site photovoltaic projects, that requirement is $10 per annual quantity subject to a minimum of $50,000. And to delay or to extend the first REC delivery deadline to May 31st, 2027, we are looking for a requirement of $20 times the annual quantity under the contract subject to a $100,000 minimum. To meet these collateral requirements, you can provide us either cash or a letter of credit. And if you're relying on your guarantor's credit worthiness or your credit worthiness, if you have a investment grade rating, we will grant you an unsecured credit line to meet that performance assurance requirement. So investment grade rating, we're looking at BBB minus from S&P or Fitch and a Baa3 or above rating from Moody's. And that will grant you a collateral pressure of $2.5 million towards meeting that collateral requirement. Any collateral requirement exposure that is above the collateral pressure of $2.5 million, if the unsecured credit line is granted to you, you must meet that using cash or a letter of credit under the terms of the contract. The letters of credit, as well as the guarantee documents, the template of those are provided as exhibits to the REC contract themselves. Certainly, if you're relying on the credit worthiness of a guarantor, we cannot grant you a unsecured credit line unless we have received from you an acceptable guarantee, acceptable to buyer. So the delivery obligations, I'll go through that on this slide 25 onwards. I will try to break this down in a very tangible way for you to understand. So I said a couple of times that we are after something called the vintage period or acceptable vintage period. The acceptable vintage period will be for a 20-year period. Actually, more precisely, it will be for a total of 241 months. And the delivery term will start when the first REC is issued by GETS or NRETS, whenever that first REC is being issued for a project. we will look at then what vintage it is tied to, those first recs. So the first rec will start the 20-year clock for the contract and the acceptable vintage period. So the vintage of the first rec that is being issued will be the earliest vintage month in the acceptable vintage period, and that first vintage month cannot be earlier than June of 2022. And if it is a project that is already up and running and delivering recs at this time, but still considered new under the law, then the earliest vintage month will be considered on June of 2022. So June of 2022, if that's the earliest vintage month, we will count 241 months after, that will be the latest vintage month. And the other point to take note of is delivery obligations. The first rec delivery must be received in each of the buyer's account no later than May 31st of 2025 and could be extended to May 31st of 2027 if you post increased collateral requirement under the contract. So just to recap, I've mentioned three time dimensions here. So the first is the acceptable vintage period. That is the period in which the underlying electricity must be generated, and the acceptable vintage period will be for a period of 241 months in total. The delivery term will kind of trail with that. It starts when the first rec is issued by GATS or MRATS, and then it will run and it will end sort of after the last vintage month. So it will end 3 months after the last vintage month, to be more precise, in recognition of the fact that the delivery of RECs will trail or lag behind when the generation of electricity month will occur. So for electricity that is produced in June, we will not expect GATS or MRATS to issue you a REC until the end of July. So it is in recognition of the lag time that the tracking systems issues these RECs that we have extended the delivery term after the vintage of these RECs. So the delivery term as well as the acceptable vintage period will then be divided into what we call delivery years. So each delivery year will start on June of a year and end May of the following year. Delivery obligations are going to be accounted in each delivery year. There is something called in the contract the delivery year requirement. That's what you need to hit in terms of REC deliveries each delivery year. These delivery obligations are going to be based again on the vintage of the RECs. So we're going to look at all the RECs that are delivered based on vintages from June through May of a year to see whether you meet the delivery year requirements for such year. The delivery year is then divided into delivery months, and the way invoicing will occur is that invoices are due on a monthly basis. Invoice will be due for a particular month, 10 days immediately following the delivery month. So if you deliver RECs in June, by the 10th day of July, we will expect to see your invoice for your June deliveries. And payment will be due by the end of the month of receipt of those invoices. So in this case, you know, RECs with a June 2022 vintage are expected to have a REC delivery at the end of July. When you deliver your RECs by the end of July, we expect you to provide an invoice by August 10, and payment will be due by the end of August. The obligation of the delivery year requirement, how we calculate the delivery year requirements, the delivery year obligation. This is on slide 27. The delivery requirement is a defined term in the contract, and it is more or less the annual quantity in each delivery year, except for a stop period upfront, as well as at the back end, to account for the fact that you will energize your projects as it goes along. It's not going to be neatly on June 1st of a year. It's not going to neatly end on May 31st of 20 years after. So because of that, the delivery requirements will kind of vary on a pro rata basis. So that's the first thing to note. The second thing to note is that for the first 365 days, we're going to offer you a 50% discount in terms of what you need to hit. And we're going to go through an example later on. And there are two or three other items to note for you here. First is that there are ineligible racks defined by any racks that are of a vintage that is outside the acceptable vintage period. These are racks that are ineligible for payment, and they are the exclusive property of seller. You can use them however you want, but if they are outside of the acceptable vintage period, they are not eligible for payment. The second is excess racks. We have an annual quantity that we ask you to bid in the procurement process. That is what we will need for planning purposes and budgeting purposes in the contract. And so any delivery requirements that is going to be calculated under the contract is going to be based on the annual quantity that is in the contract. And any racks that are in excess of those requirements in a delivery year, they are called excess racks. And those are also not eligible for payment, and they are the exclusive property of seller. In terms of what shortfalls are, is if you miss a delivery year requirement in a delivery year, that is a shortfall year. And the amounts that you're short are what we call shortfall amounts. So if you fail to meet the delivery year requirement in any of three or more years, and the amount of your shortfall exceeds the annual quantity, that is when we will call this an event of default, where your contract will be terminated and you will forfeit your collateral requirement. So just take note, we are really serious about you naming a annual quantity that we can rely on, and the requirements here kind of ask you to consider carefully and seriously the annual quantity. That is how we will calculate and the obligations that you have to meet under the contract. The examples are provided here. This is an example that kind of show you what happens in the stop year. In the illustrative example at the bottom, you'll see that the first thing we do, if you name an annual quantity and the annual quantity is allocated to the each of the contracts, in this case, is 3,650 racks. That quantity will then be calculated first for the first 365 days and then separately for the racks going forward. So in order to get to the delivery year requirement, we first have to divide the annual quantity that you name and that gets subsequently calculated and allocated to each contract by either 365 days or 366 days to get to what we call a daily quantity. The daily quantity would be half of that for the first 365 days and then resume to 100% of that for the remainder of the term. And if you look to the rightmost box, the delivery term will have a earliest vintage of August 1st of 2022. And for the period August 1st, 2022 through the following May 31st, 2023, that is considered one delivery year, even though it's a partial delivery year. And that deliverier, the first stop deliverier, will consist of 304 days. So what we do is that we will take the daily quantity, multiply by 304, and that's how we get to the minimum of 1,520 racks and the maximum of 3,040 racks for the first 304 days. And then for the first delivery year, for the subsequent year two, again we follow that same idea to yield to 3,345 racks as the minimum and 36,050 racks for the maximum. And that again has to do with how we prorate what is left in the first 365 days in the beginning of year two. For the rest of the delivery years, you can expect to basically hit the annual quantity that we are after, with some proration occurring on the last delivery year, the 21st delivery year in this case. For invoicing and payments, this contract will feature index rack payments, and how it works is that through the utility rack contract, we will insert the strike price that you name in your RFP proposal. In your bid price, we will have the strike price. At each hour, we will calculate the hourly component, which is really the index price at the hub, the Illinois trading hub, either the PJM NYHub or the MISO Illinois hub that you will choose and select in the RFP process. The index price minus the strike price at each hour multiplied by the megawatt hour generation of the project during that hour will be what will be the payment, the hourly component of the payment for that hour. And in terms of the monthly price, we will just simply sum up all the hourly components of that vintage month, divide by all of the megawatt hour produced by the project during that month. If the price is positive, then seller will pay buyer the invoice amount. If the price is negative, then buyer will pay seller the invoice amount. This makes sure that either through the electricity markets or through the REC contract, you will get to the strike price that you have indicated in your bid proposal. The invoice amount will simply be the monthly REC price as calculated, multiplied by the RECs that are delivered associated with such vintage months. So that's pretty much how it will work. So there are a couple of things to point out to you on this slide. The first is that the comparison of the index price and the strike price occurs on an hourly basis, but the monthly price and the invoice amount are calculated on a monthly basis. The index price is going to be the real-time price tied to either the PJM NYHub or the MISO Illinois Hub, but the megawatt hour generation will be tied to how much your project has generated during that hour as recorded in the keynote. So both are two different types of numbers that from two different locations, rather, but are all required for the hourly price component as well as the monthly price calculations. The last thing to flag for you here is that the invoice amount would be built off the monthly price and the RECs that are delivered. Monthly price will be calculated based on the megawatt hour of generation produced by the project, but we cannot pay you until the RECs are delivered, and the RECs being delivered will form the quantity component of the invoice amount. So in terms of the timeline more specifically, you will see here on this slide 31, RECs will be invoiced on a monthly basis after the REC deliveries has occurred. But from left to right, here is the timeline. Assuming that electricity is produced in June of 2022. Then 5 days after the electricity production month of June, that puts us into July 5th, we will ask you to provide hourly generation data as well as the real-time LMP at the hub to buyer as well as the IPA. That's a reporting requirement under Article 6 of your contract. The IPA will then take that information and issue to buyer, sell, and seller the June 2022 monthly REC price. So this is all even before RECs are being issued and delivered by GATS or MRETs. This is just looking at production of electricity. So that occurs by July 20th for a June production month. So we expect that there will be a lag between when electricity is produced and when GATS and MRETs will issue the RECs. And typically the expectation is that GATS or MRETs will issue the RECs for June by the end of July. So RECs are issued by the end of July and you will deliver those RECs via the standing order at that time. If those RECs are received by buyer by July 29, then we expect the invoice to come from you by August the 10th and we will pay you by the end of August for those RECs. So again, the REC monthly price is going to be tied to a vintage month, not the month when RECs are issued, not the month when it is delivered, or even when your invoice is issued to the buyer counterparty. Just take note of this. In terms of the invoice calculation and the monthly settlement, so a few things here. You will issue your invoice to buyer on a monthly basis. And this will be based on at least two things. One is the monthly price that is being confirmed by the IPA to buyer and seller, and the quantity that is being delivered to the buyer counterparty. And right after the delivery month, you will issue the invoice to buyer regardless of the price, whether it's positive or negative, regardless of whether you pay the buyer or buyer pays you under the index REC contract. If the price is positive, where buyer is supposed to pay, where seller is supposed to pay buyer, you may request buyer issue you an invoice for documentary purposes. But in general, we expect the invoice to always come from the seller counterparty. There shall be one invoice issued in each month for each vintage of RECs that is being delivered. If you're delivering RECs and you might have missed one or two invoices, you are required to issue one invoice per vintage month. And all invoices will be netted together and paid by the last business day of the month in which the invoices are received. So in this case, we calculate a REC monthly price that is negative $2.98 per REC. The quantity that is being delivered is 80 RECs. And so these RECs tied to the June 2022 vintage will be paid by the end of August. And the invoice amount is simply the multiplication of those two numbers. In terms of reporting requirements, here, these are requirements stated in Article 6 of the REC contract. Five business days after each month of electricity production or generation, we will ask you to provide a monthly generation report that tells us what the megawatt hour generation is at the project's keynote. We will also ask you to provide us the hourly real-time LMP at the applicable index hub or trading hub for your index price. So that's the first item. We will be curious to know from you whether the PJM power meter system and the MISO market portal is the right hubs or the right portals and systems for us to verify your hourly megawatt hour generation data for your project. So we will need data in order to calculate the monthly price that is weighted by the megawatt hour production. And this is the information that we are asking you to provide. And in particular, we're asking for read-only access rights to the PJM power meter system, as well as the MISO market portal, for us to verify the megawatt hour generation data of your particular project. Other things that are here, prevailing wage requirements. You have to provide to the IPA documents or verification and documentation that demonstrates that all construction activities have been performed by employees who have been paid by you at the general prevailing rate of hourly wages. And this documentation must be provided within 5 business days of the date of first operations of the project, or if the project is already operational at this time or have begun prior to the enactment of CEJA since September of last year, then you can provide that to us by the effective date of the agreement. But if anything is occurring prior to the enactment of CEJA, those are not required to comply with the prevailing wage requirements if they are not ongoing requirements here. And if the work is still being performed subsequent to your initial submission, then we ask that you provide any updates to us no later than July 15, following the end of the delivery year when the work is done or performed. In terms of the project labor agreement requirements, the project labor agreement has to be filed with the IPA. This is a collective bargaining agreement that covers specific terms and conditions for employment for construction activities. And there is a provision in Article 6 that requires you to provide the project labor agreements as well as any amendments to the IPA. And you shall work with the IPA to file these agreements in accordance with the procedures established by the IPA. So with that, I will just pause here to take questions. If you have any questions at this time before we dive next into the other sections, I want to at least stop here, raise your hands. We'll get to you to unmute you to ask your questions. We'll try to address them with a time permitting before we jump onto the next section.
Okay, great. I'm seeing some participants raising their hands. I'll start with Michael S. and then move to Sarah D.
Thank you. And just a reminder, you do not need to identify your affiliations or your company as you provide your comments to us. We do ask that if you do provide us your comments verbally, we'll take note of them, but also provide that to us in writing as well so that we can track those comments. So Michael S., you can ask your questions or your comments now. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Vensi. It's Michael S. Good to talk to you. I can go by my firm initials, FVL&D. Quick question on the timing of delivery for first rec. Understood the new structure and generally appreciate it. I guess I was wondering if there's any thought to language give it around a pause in federal interconnections, federally regulated interconnections, considering PJM has been raising that possibility.
Yes, thanks for that question. We do have some provisions in the force majeure section of the contract, and you can find that in Article 10 of the written draft agreement. You can take a look there, but there are some language surrounding what happens if there are delays in permitting or interconnection. Is Is there a follow-up question? Hearing none. Katie, who do we have as the next participant?
Sure, we have Sarah G. I'll give you permission to talk, Sarah.
Hi, yes, this is quite specific. I was wondering for the project labor agreement. It's typical for us to have one of those with our construction contractors, but would we also have to get a PLA with the commissioners? So for example, if Vestas comes in after wind turbines are constructed and they do the final commissioning of the turbines, do we need to have a separate project labor agreement with Vestas, or could they possibly co-sign with our construction contractor?
Thank you, Sarah G, for the question. Let me see if someone from the IPA may be able to answer this question. If not, I suspect I will have to get back to you via an FAQ on this.
Thank you.
I'm not familiar. This is Kelly Turner from the IPA. I'm not familiar with what exactly is involved in the commissioning of the project itself. So I think the format of the project labor agreement, whether it's specifically with the general contractor or with individual subcontractors, I just think that for all construction activities, it has to be covered. And I think we can look into more specifics on the commissioning question itself.
Okay, thank you. That's Ms. Kelly Turner from the IPA Deputy Legal Counsel. So Sarah, we will get back to you on that question in written form as an FAQ on the website in due time. Thanks for the question.
Okay, next we have a question from Don Fisher. I'll allow you to talk.
Okay, Don, do you have your question? Feel free to speak.
Yeah, I was just wondering on the max contract quantity, it looks like it's just the annual quantity times 20 years. So for degradation, do we need to take that into account when we sign up for the annual quantity?
That's a good question. So the short answer is the contract as well as the RFP itself do not account for those and make no distinction about degradation in our case. We'll ask you for an annual quantity that you must adhere to, and that is what, when you're awarded, will be allocated to the utility contracts and what you'll be committing to with some flexibility. The flexibility basically provides that you will not be considered an event of default if you miss the annual quantity in any year, but that we allow you to miss three or more years, and the shortfall amount has to be exceeding the annual quantity in the contract, and that is when the penalties will occur. So just to reiterate, that whatever the degradation would be, whether it's solar, wind, or brownfield, you have to calculate that on your end and come back with one annual number that we can then hold to under the terms of the contract.
So regarding what you were talking about the three kind of consecutive shortfall years, can you do, can you use excess to make up for a shortfall year?
At this time, we're not allowing for banking of RECs. So if you have excess in a previous year, it cannot be made up in a subsequent year, only because the price is tied to a vintage month. So when you calculate for a month, the delivery year has ended, you're going into a different delivery year. Those are very specific to what the month of production would be, and that's why the banking of RECs typically found in fixed price contracts are not allowed in this index rack contract.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
We have a question here from Sean B. Sean, I'm gonna allow you to talk.
Hey, Sean, you can unmute yourself and-
There we go, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hey, great. I've got about five questions.
Sure. Ask one at a time, maybe. I'll try to answer.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first question I have has to do with the bid assurance collateral. And that's changed quite a bit from previous years. Why has that gone up so significantly? Because we're seeing that that's going to be an impact on participation.
Sure. Just let me clarify, are you referring to bid assurance collateral or performance assurance collateral under the
bid assurance collateral?
Okay. The bid assurance, we will pause that for the latter half of this presentation.
Okay.
Edie Olambi will go through the bid assurance requirements.
Okay.
The second question you have, Sean?
That might be also then the second part. I had a question about the indicative quantity.
Ah, I see. Okay.
Then I got a question then about the calculation of the IREC.
Yes.
I have a couple of questions around this. The language in the contract refers to actual generation. And I don't think, the conversation here didn't really, maybe it did. You didn't use the term actual generation, but you did say that the seller will be providing hourly generation data and as well as hourly LMPs.
Yeah.
But how are you accounting for a solar projects, the difference between solar projects and solar projects with batteries, are actual generation going to be considered the same? Is it actually the time that the electricity is generated, or are you going to be accounting for when batteries inject into batteries discharge?
Yeah, that's a good question. Do you have a comment on that, whether it should be one or the other?
Yes, we're thinking it should be at the time that the generation, that the power is actually generated, and not at the time that the battery is discharging.
Okay, thanks.
And we'll be putting that in written comments. I just want to know if you had something up front to better understand where you were at.
I think that's sort of where our thinking is quite similar on that. But just to clarify for everybody's sake, I think to be very clear, the production of electricity occurs before the RECs are actually issued by GATS or MRECs. So just to avoid any doubt and clarify up front, the production of electricity is going to be at the keynote where the project sits, the generation is what is produced by the utility scale projects or the brownfield projects, not the battery. We're going to ask you for that megawatt generation number. We're going to take the index hub price at either NYHUB or MISO Illinois hub, not at the PINO. And that price minus the strike divide by the hourly generation at that hour is what bills, it's what we will be building off to figure out what the monthly price is when we aggregate throughout the month. But that is only the price component. The actual quantity component of the payments will be based on the actual RECs that are being delivered to the buyer's account. So that's a mouthful, but there are different components that I just want to tease out and make sure everybody's on the same page. Yeah.
Great, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions, Sean?
Yeah, I'm going to move on. I got a question about the standing order.
Yes, sir.
And how that relates to excess RECs. So we're not allowed to we take excess RECs. You're not going to be paying for excess, or the utilities don't purchase excess RECs but yet we've got a standing order that is all the time. And so how is that going to be managed? Say we a project meets its annual quantity before the end of the delivery year. What happened? And we've got excess recs. How is that handled with the standing order?
Yeah, that's a good question. So my understanding is that there could be something that is applied in both GATS or MRETs could be differently handled, but you can basically set a acceptable vintage period, one, and two, you can also set a quantity cap. I've yet to verify this with the administrators at GATS or MRETs for anything different, but certainly if you are having a different understanding of how the standing order is set up, please let us know.
Yeah, because I think that there's kind of a concern there as far as the timing around the excess recs and how that's managed. And we'll have, and related to that is kind of bleed into my next and probably my final question here is the idea of, and someone had asked this question, I think Sarah may have done, asked a question about the use of the excess recs. And there are a couple of ways it could be used. One, either to make up for shortages in prior years. I think you addressed that. Mm-hmm. But what about the idea of using those RECs in like a secondary market where therefore they would be used to fulfill the same vintage and therefore we're kind of maximizing or optimizing the use of RECs being produced by approved projects within Illinois. So are you open to ideas around kind of a secondary market for RECs?
Yeah, probably that's outside the scope of this procurement event. But okay. I think I hear you. And I guess the clear line that we're trying to make here is that any RECs that are in excess of the delivery requirements, the seller's property, you can sell them however you want. If you find a secondary market for them, you can use the RECs for that purpose, but we are not under the proposed terms buying those RECs at this time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then are you going to be talking about the forward price curve and later in the second part? Because I guess there's an interest in better understanding the forward price curve and how that's going to forecast the budget. Maybe that's outside of today's conversation, but there's an interest in understanding that.
Yeah, that's kind of outside of today's discussion only because it doesn't have a direct impact on establishing a payment cap for this index rec contract.
Right.
So I just want to make sure that is clear that there's language in the law about the forward price curve being developed for procurement planning purposes. That's really something that the IPA will look into for purposes of the RPS budget, but not something that is directly tied to establishing a direct payment cap for capping payments under this contract specifically.
Do you know when that will be reviewed with folks? Will it be under the long-term plan then, not necessarily within this contract?
This is Anthony Starr. Yes, that would be in the context of the long-term plan.
All right. Thank you. That's all my questions. Thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Sean. In the interest of time, maybe we'll take another question before we jump on to the next section of the presentation. Katie, are there others?
I think we have questions through the chat here that I can read off.
Oh, sure.
So we have a question from Gregory H. Can we expect to receive guidance from the IPA for RECs generated from other renewable energy resources, such as waste heat to power technology?
This is Anthony again. That's outside the scope of what we're discussing today, which is this specific procurement that was contained in Public Act 102-0662, which is for renewable energy credits from new utility scale wind, solar, and brownfield sites. Any discussion of consideration of procurements for other technologies would have to be through the context of our long-term plan development process.
And one other question from John P. Did I hear correctly that collateral will not be accepted from seller who is not rated and who does not have a guarantor who is rated? Is this despite the fact that the LC will be furnished by a highly rated bank per instructions of the LC?
Yeah. So let me try to unpack that a little bit. The collateral requirement must be met by all sellers. The only distinction that we are making is that if you are a investment rated entity or if you are relying on a investment rate grade entity as your guarantor, you will be granted a unsecured line of credit to cover all or part of your collateral requirement. And if you don't have a rated entity, investment grade rated entity to stand on, then you must meet that fully using either a letter of credit or cash. And are there other questions, Katie?
No. That's all the questions we've received at this point.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks everyone for your questions. Now I'll turn the time over to Katie to run over the remainder of today's presentation. We'll stop at the end of the presentation to take more questions and comments from you. Thank you. Katie?
Okay, great. So I'm going to start off this next section with the schedule for the RFP process and the steps that applicants will take to qualify their project or projects. Then I'll go through the requirements for a project to qualify to submit bids in the RFP. And then in the last section, I'll discuss bid submission and evaluation. So the RFP would kick off in mid-March, and then it'll proceed over the following 2 months. We'll hold a webcast on March 21st to cover the final contract and RFP rules and eligibility criteria that will be posted by March 18th. So the qualification process is in two parts, and the first part is the part one proposal when bidders submit their qualification materials. Applicants begin submitting these on Tuesday, March 22nd, and the part one proposal materials would be due on the part one date, which is Wednesday, April 6th. Applicants will be given time to cure any deficiencies. You can respond to requests for additional information or clarifications from the procurement administrator. And then by April 21st, that's the part one notification date, applicants would be informed whether they've qualified to submit a part two proposal. And the part two proposal mostly includes the posting of the bid assurance collateral with each of ComEd, Ameren, and MidAmerican. And I'm going to cover that requirement, including the required amounts in the draft rules, later on in this presentation. The part two window opens on Friday, April 22nd, and closes on the part two date on Friday, April 29th. And then applicants that have a successful part two proposal can submit bids on the bid date, which would be the following Friday, May 6th. And on that date, the bids that are selected will be subject to commission approval. So applicants that are submitting to qualify multiple projects will submit a separate proposal for each project. And again, the part one is to respond to the qualification standards, and the part two consists mainly of certifications and posting bid assurance collateral with all three companies. So bid assurance collateral can be in the form of cash or a letter of credit. The part one and part two materials are going to be submitted entirely online via online forms. You're going to upload information and supporting documentation, and then you'll post bid assurance collateral electronically with the companies. And just a note here that if you're presenting multiple projects, information that's common to all projects will only need to be submitted one time. There are two fees associated with the Index Rec RFP. First is the bid participation fee of $500. This fee is paid by all applicants to the IPA with the Part 1 proposal. And each bidder pays one time, even if it submits multiple proposals for multiple projects. The second fee is the supplier fee. This fee is paid by winning projects only to the IPA, and it's due within 7 business days of the Commission's decision on the results of the RFP, and we'll provide an estimate of this fee with the webcast on March 21st. So this slide is really the first of 10 slides. It's going to cover detailed requirements that are submitted with the Part 1 proposal. So first off, you're going to be asked to name the bidder and the seller. The bidder is the entity that submits the proposal. The seller is the entity that signs the contract if the project is selected and approved by the Commission. The seller must be an entity that has been formed as of the Part 1 date. And if there are multiple projects, the bidder and the seller entities do not have to be the same. You're going to provide contact information for representatives that can respond to questions regarding your proposal and project. And then you're going to name an officer of the seller. This is an individual who has the power to undertake contracts and to bind the seller. He or she is going to make certifications throughout the Part 1 and Part 2. In the Part 1 proposal, you're going to provide some basic information for your project, including the name. You're going to give it a name that will be used consistently throughout the RFP, a system size in megawatt AC rating, and you'll also provide the first date of operation, either actual or expected. So bids that started operations prior to June 1, 2017 are not eligible. And if the project is not operational as of the time you submit your Part 1 proposal, then the expected date of first operation should be on or before May 31st, 2025. Also, the officer of the seller is going to acknowledge the Prevailing Wage Act requirements and certify that the seller, including its contractors and subcontractors rendering services under the Index Direct contract, will comply with the requirements of the Prevailing Wage Act, including but not limited to all wage requirements and notice and record keeping duties. These Prevailing Wage Act requirements under the contract apply to construction activities that take place on or after September 15, 2021. So the draft rules include the project labor agreement requirements. If construction activities for the project began prior to September 15, 2021, then this requirement does not apply to the project. But if construction activities have begun as of the submission of the Part 1 proposal, so that's on or after September 15th, but prior to submission of Part 1, then the bidder provides evidence that a project labor agreement has been filed with the IPA and that the IPA has determined that the project labor agreement meets the requirements under the IPA Act and the Project Labor Agreement Act. Now, this is a requirement that we're specifically calling out for comment here or in written feedback. We're really interested in feedback about this requirement for participation, and in particular, whether the Project Labor Agreement must be filed with the proposal for eligibility purposes or perhaps 6 months to a year thereafter, in which case there'd be a penalty such as losing posted collateral should the seller fail to provide an acceptable project labor agreement. So we'd appreciate hearing comments on that. You can let us know today or provide them on Wednesday when written comments are due. If construction activities have not begun as of the submission of the Part 1 proposal, then the seller acknowledges the requirements under the Index Direct contract and certifies that the project will be built by general contractors that have entered into a project labor agreement prior to construction, certify that the project labor agreement will be filed with the IPA in accordance with requirements under the Index Direct contract, and that the PLA will specify the terms and conditions as defined by the Project Labor Agreements Act. And so these terms and conditions are specified in paragraph 4.2.1 of the draft rules that are posted. So required information regarding the project site differs between utility scale wind and solar versus brownfield projects. So this slide covers requirements only applicable to utility scale wind and solar. So applicants will provide the complete address for the project along with a map of the project site that clearly shows the location of the project. And for utility scale wind and solar, a project must be located in Illinois or a state adjacent to Illinois. So in order to qualify a project that's located in a state adjacent to Illinois, the project must meet public interest criteria in the Act and be pre-approved by the IPA to be eligible for Illinois RPS compliance. So currently on the IPA's website, there's an evaluation spreadsheet that can be downloaded and completed and submitted to the IPA for approval. So if you have a project located in an adjacent state, you can actually go ahead at any time now. You can click on this link, download the spreadsheet, and submit it using the instructions within that sheet. It's located on the IPA site under the header Adjacent State Facility Eligibility. And again, there's no need to wait for the Part 1 window. You can submit that to the IPA. This next slide and the next three slides are going to pertain to qualifying a brownfield site. So the brownfield site photovoltaic project must be located in Illinois. Applicants have to provide the complete address for the project along with a map of the project site. Importantly, the project must be entirely contained within the brownfield site. And projects that are co-located with another facility on a greenfield site must disclose this fact. So the project contained within the brownfield site will have a single dedicated meter and will have an account registered with PJM, GATS, or MRENS. Now the project site must fit into one of the two buckets under the definition of the Act. Either one, the project site is regulated by the U.S. EPA or Illinois EPA under one of the four programs in the Act, and I'm going to list those on the next slide. Or the project site is located at the site of a coal mine that has permanently ceased coal production, permanently halted any remining operations, and is no longer accepting any coal combustion residues. So this site has both completed all cleanup and remediation obligations under the Federal Surface Mining and Reclamation Act of 1977 and all applicable Illinois rules and other cleanup remediation. Definition goes on to require demonstrated compliance with all applicable federal and state environmental rules and regulations. So this slide provides the four programs under which a brownfield site qualifying under the first bucket must be regulated. The table provides the applicable program on the left, and then a list of sufficient documentation that can be provided as evidence that the project is regulated by that program on the right. And the program administrator may consider other forms of documentation that's provided under the program. Any document that's submitted must be dated no earlier than 25 years prior to the bid date, that being May 6, 2022. And there are additional requirements for projects that are regulated by the IEPA site remediation program. So those additional requirements for sites regulated under the site remediation program pertain to demonstrating actual blight or contamination at the project site. And sufficient documentation would be one of the following that's listed here. You could provide proof that the project site is also regulated by one of the other three programs on the prior slide, or demonstration of contamination at the project site and determination of the need for remediation activities through a site assessment from the U.S. EPA targeted brownfields assessment, or you could provide additional documents from the IEPA site remediation program, which means if available, a remedial action completion report and a no further remediation letter, or if those documents are not available, then a certification from the bidder that the documents have not been issued by the IEPA site remediation program. Now, for a project that's located at the site of a permanently closed coal mine, in the draft rules, sufficient supporting documentation for that site means all of the following: a copy of the permits for coal mining operations, including a copy of the reclamation plan that's been approved by the Department of Natural Resources, a copy of the Department of Natural Resources decision approving the permits, and then documented confirmation that the reclamation phases 1, 2, and 3 have been completed for the project site by providing evidence that the entirety of the performance bond for the project site has been released. And so in order to meet number 3, an example of sufficient evidence of the performance bond release would be a screenshot from the Illinois mine permits map that shows the phase 3 status as released, or it could be other documentation if appropriate. The permits should cover the entirety of the project site. This is another slide here where we're calling out for comment. We'd like to hear your feedback on any alternative documentation that would be available for coal mine sites to provide sufficient evidence that the site meets the definition in the Act. If you plan to comment on this requirement, and sample documentation is available, please provide that. And also please note that any alternative documentation we would expect would be issued by the Department of Natural Resources, the agency that regulates coal mines in Illinois. So with this slide, we're back to discussing eligibility requirements applicable to all 3 categories of projects. So in the Part 1 proposal, projects will be required to meet a project maturity requirement. This can be accomplished by providing documentation listed in the table from PJM, MISO, or utility, or it can be demonstrating site control for a portion of the project site. So if you can provide a document from the table on this slide, you do not need to provide evidence of site control. And if you have not started the interconnection process, that's no problem. You can still qualify if you can show documented evidence of site control for a portion of the site. So if the project is interconnecting with PJM, the applicant can provide the QOASIS ID and a copy of the completed system impact study. If interconnecting with MISO, if the project is in DPP 2020 cycle 1 or later study cycle, then please provide the project number and a copy of the preliminary system impact study under DPP 1. If interconnecting with MISO in an earlier study cycle, then you'll be asked to provide the project number and a copy of the fully executed. Interconnecting with a utility, the fully executed interconnection agreement should be provided if available. So if these documents are not available, or if a document that shows that the project is farther along and the interconnection process is not available, then the bidder will be required to describe the stage of development of the project, and then, like I said, demonstrate site control for a portion of the project site. So to figure out how much site control is required, you can use this slide here. You'll need to demonstrate site control for at least 40 acres times the project site for a utility scale wind project, 4 acres times the project size for a utility scale solar project, and 3 times the project size for a brownfield site photovoltaic project. So this table here at the bottom of the slide provides a list of acceptable documentation to demonstrate site control, for example, a lease agreement, or a purchase agreement. And so there's many different types of documents that will be accepted, and the full list is actually provided in the draft rules at this time. And please note that you can provide different documents for different landowners. If the document that you provide is a letter of intent or a memorandum of understanding, then it has to satisfy specific minimum requirements. And the minimum requirements are listed in a document as Appendix 4 to the draft RFP rules. And so that document's posted and available for review and comment at this time. The seller is going to be required to make a number of certifications regarding the project and the seller entity. These certifications are listed in section 4.6 of the draft RFP rules. Examples for the project include meeting that the project meets the requirements of the rules, that the project has reached the appropriate development milestones, that there will be no substitution for another project, and that the project's not a repowered facility. In regards to the seller, the officer will be required to accept the terms of the contract and acknowledge the collateral requirements under the REC contract. Additionally, new under the Act, a bidder and seller cannot be in violation of the Displaced Energy Workers Bill of Rights. So there will be at least a certification required in the proposal. This requirement is still being finalized, so there's more information to come on this. For solar projects, the officer will certify that the project has been installed or will be installed by qualified persons. And in regards to brownfield, the seller must certify that the project is not a community renewable generation project. So these are just examples. Like I said, the full list of certifications are listed in section 4.6 of the draft rule. That completes the overview of the eligibility requirements for the Part 1 proposal included in the draft rules. So qualified applicants that have a successful Part 1 will be required to post bid assurance collateral during the Part 2 window in order to qualify to submit bids on the bid date. So bid assurance collateral is posted in the form of cash or a pre-bid letter of credit, and it's provided to each company separately. So the amount is a function of the project size, and it's subject to a ceiling. The required amounts from the draft rules on a per megawatt basis and the applicable ceilings are provided here on this table. So for example, if you're submitting a proposal for a utility scale wind project, you'll post $1,600 per megawatt with Ameren, $4,000 per megawatt with ComEd, and $400 per megawatt with MidAmerican. And the amount you post with each company across all of the wind projects that you present is subject to a ceiling that's specific to each company. Should you choose to issue a letter of credit to meet the bid assurance requirement, the letter of credit must be submitted electronically, and it should be in the standard form provided as an appendix to the rules or include modifications that have been reviewed and approved by the companies. So using a standard form ensures bidders are held to the same standard. And these forms are currently posted to the draft documents page of the website and can be reviewed and commented on. During the Part 1 process, that's when applicants would have an opportunity to submit modifications from their bank to the companies for review. And then modifications that are acceptable to a company are compiled and posted to the website, and any applicant can use them in their letter of credit. Okay, with that, I'm going to move to two final slides related to bidding and bid evaluation. So your bid is going to have three elements. First, you're going to provide a strike price for the project that's in dollar per megawatt hour. You're going to provide a full quantity, and that represents the annual quantity of RECs the seller is offering to deliver. And lastly, you'll provide a minimum quantity that represents the minimum annual quantity of RECs that the seller is willing to accept as a partial award. So a project could receive a partial award, so that would be less than the full quantity, but never below the minimum quantity if that project is the marginal project selected in bid evaluation. And the marginal project is the project that, if selected, would mean exceeding the target in that category. So very importantly, in the bid form, you'll also select the index hub, either MISO Illinois Hub or PJM Northern Illinois Hub, that corresponds to the bid for the project. And so this hub will be used for purposes of payment under the contract for that project. The quantity of RECs bid for a project cannot exceed a maximum bid size. The maximum bid size is calculated on the basis of a 45% capacity factor for wind projects and a 30% capacity factor for solar and brownfield projects. So importantly, the bid evaluation is going to proceed independently for each category. First, the bids with strike prices that fail to meet or beat a benchmark for a category are eliminated. Second, bids in each category are ranked from lowest to highest in order of strike price. And then in order of strike price, the full quantities of projects with the lowest strike prices are selected. In regards to the marginal project is selected for at least the minimum quantity or the target is unfilled. And then lastly, projects with bids approved by the commission are then allocated to each company according to the procurement administrator. So that concludes the overview of the qualification requirements and bid evaluation from the draft RFP rules. And before we move to questions, I just have two last slides that provide the details related to submitting your comments by Wednesday. So currently posted are two invitations to comment. They're posted to the draft documents page of the website. And the first document pertains to the draft contract. Again, comments on the draft contract are due by Wednesday, February 9th. To submit your comments, you'll download the draft contract and mark comments with track changes in Microsoft Word. And as necessary, you can provide a separate document with explanatory notes. You submit your comments by email to the procurement administrator at illinois-rfp@nera.com. And notably, comments will be published to the procurement website, so stakeholders can designate any portion of its response as confidential. And please note that the procurement administrator and the IPA do reserve the right to further redact information prior to posting. The second invitation to comment posted pertains to the draft rules. So stakeholders can submit comments on any aspect of the rules and appendices that are posted. Also, in that invitation to comment, in Appendix A, there's a table of requirements to aid in review. So if you do not, you know, have the time to view the entirety of the rules and appendices, please feel free to review the table of requirements and provide comments on that table. We're seeking feedback on topics 1 to 3 listed here specifically. So on the timing of the project labor agreement requirements and the proposal, the requirements for projects located at the site of a permanently closed coal mine, and then information surrounding the appropriate systems for monthly generation reporting. Again, you'll submit your comments to us at illinois-rfp@nera.com by February 9th. And these comments will also be published to the website. And like the contract comments, you can designate any portion as confidential, and we reserve the right to further redact comments before posting. So at this point, please raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question. Okay. Akhil C., I'm going to go ahead and give you ability to talk.
Thank you. I've got two questions. So first one, can you elaborate a little bit more on how the benchmark price will be derived as it relates to bid evaluation?
Actually, no information is provided besides for the fact that the benchmark is filed with commission and approved ahead of the bid date.
The benchmark filed with what? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that.
With the commission and approved ahead of the bid date.
This is Anthony Starr. The Act requires the benchmark to be confidential.
Oh, understood. I was trying to figure out what you guys use as your criteria to come up with that, but that's fine. And then second question, what qualitative factors will you guys use for your bid evaluation? It seems like it's a function primarily of price, but I thought you guys would also take other items into consideration, like, you know, an area that may have a retired facility.
No, the evaluation is price only. So if the project can qualify via an acceptable part one and part two, then the evaluation will only account for the bid that's submitted, the price in the bid.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Sure. Brennan B., you should be able to speak.
Thank you. My question pertains to the requirements of project located at the site of a permanently closed mine.
Yeah.
There is a note that says, you know, one of the requirements is that it's not accepting, I believe, coal ash or remnants from a coal plant, I think. At what point does it have to have stopped receiving the byproducts? Is it the time of construction, time of the project going commercial, or is there a specific date in relation to the project? Thanks.
Well, you'll need to provide documented evidence that the site meets the requirements at the point of the part one proposal. And so I guess it'd be great if you could comment on that more, but you know, I think the cutoff point is really at the point of qualifying the project site.
Yeah, I would you know, a number of mines, you know, may be taking some remnants now, but, you know, wouldn't be taking them forever. So I would suggest that something like that, as long as it has the permit at the time and is not accepting any other byproducts at the time of, you know, I would say construction or MTP, then, you know, then it meets the requirements. But I can add more in writing.
Yeah, thanks for that comment. I appreciate hearing from you on that more.
Okay, thanks.
Dawn F., go ahead. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I do. It's about the, you know, the price tied to the index hub, and for brownfield sites where you're interconnecting to the utility and selling the power under their like QF tariff, how does that hourly price kind of come into play? Because I understand it's to balance the risk, right, when you're connecting to PJM and MISO, but under the QF tariff, isn't it a monthly price that is set when you're selling the power directly to the utility?
Yeah.
Does that make sense, or am I explaining it right?
Yeah, we may have to get back to you on that particular question. In general, the way we are looking at this is, first of all, there's a strike price that you name in the RFP process, and then there's going to be an index price, which is really just the real-time price at either the PJM NI hub or the MISO Illinois hub that you'll select as the index hub. And that's the two price reference that we have under the terms of this. I suspect you're asking a slightly different question. But if you can put that in writing to us, let us research on that if it has to do with something else, and we can get back to you on that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Sean B., go ahead.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Sean.
Great. So two questions. The first one is the bid assurance collateral increase. There was an increase in the cap, and I'm quickly trying to see slide 51. The ceilings have been increased, and I was wondering from previous procurements, wondering why they've been increased.
Yeah, sure, Sean, and you know, I appreciate any comments you have submitted in writing as well. So the amounts on a per megawatt basis are in line with prior procurement events, but the ceiling right. has been adjusted up. And that's calibrated really to match the collateral requirement under the contract. So if a bidder were to win for the entire target, it provides some assurances that the collateral requirement can be posted under the contract. And so that's sort of how it's calibrated.
Okay. I think I got that. So basically, if, are you saying if one project intends to try and meet the entire bid?
Or multiple projects from a single bidder. Yep.
Okay.
So then it would be sort of a function of the, both the target, which may be higher than a previous procurement, and the amount of collateral that's required under the contract.
Okay. And then the next question I have really wasn't discussed, or it was discussed indirectly. It's the indicative quantity that's provided in the Part 2 form.
Yep.
Why is that needed as opposed to just submitting the a megawatt hour amount in that Part 2 section? Suppose we wanted to actually submit that as opposed to some sort of an estimated value.
Yeah, it is sort of informational only. You know, it's non-binding as part of your Part 2 proposal. It's the quantity in the bid that would be binding. But it's just some information up front for us to review. And also, you know, we could provide to ensure that, you know, there's no confusion, that you don't have a quantity over the maximum you'd be allowed, that sort of thing. But it is non-binding and really informational only at that point.
Yeah, I noticed that it was using the same capacity factors for the maximum quantities. Is that the only thing that it's tied to, or are there other obligations, other more specific, are there financial obligations, maybe something around collateral, some sort of additional binding requirements that the indicative quantity would be related to, just so that we're...
No.
Okay.
No. It's really the quantity that you put into the bid, the full
okay.
in the minimum quantity.
Great. Thank you. Those are the questions I have. I will note if there's an opportunity, I'm not sure if we're running out of time. Looks like we might be.
No rush.
I had a question that related back to the previous section. I can wait till other people finish their questions on this section to address, to raise that.
Yeah. Actually, Sean, while you're here, go ahead and ask your question.
So in the regarding the REC contract itself, you mentioned the PLA. There is you need to submit like verifications even after the project is operating, and it's kind of a little nebulous on it's supposed to be verifications on work that happens after the project is operating. What kind of work would you expect to be qualified, you know, be under the project labor agreement?
Yeah, there are two requirements there. One is related to the Prevailing Wage Act requirements, and the other is the project labor agreements. The project labor agreements is simply requiring that the project is built by general contractors that have entered into a PLA prior to construction of the project itself. And we'll be asking that information from you. I guess what we are after is that if there's any amendments to the PLA, we do ask that you provide those to us 30 days of the execution of the PLA or amendments. That's sort of the idea behind that. But in general, the PLA is expected to be entered into prior to construction.
Right. Okay, great. Thanks for the clarification. That's all I had. Thank you.
Yeah, but for avoidance of doubt, I do ask that you review the section of the contract that refers back to the enabling legislation for an understanding of what the requirements are.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Before I go, maybe Kelly, do you have anything to add on that? Maybe not. Okay.
All right, Ben, I think that you captured all of that, so I don't have anything else to add.
Okay, thank you.
Sarah G.
Hi, yes, I was just hoping to get some clarification. If we're bidding in a minimum quantity and a full quantity, theoretically, could a utility come back to us with any number in between the minimum and full quantity? Is that how that would work?
Yes. If the project is the marginal project in selection, we wouldn't come back to you. You would know that your project could be selected between the full quantity and the minimum quantity, but never below the minimum quantity. And if you were to put in your bid form, you know, a minimum quantity equal to your full quantity, then you'd be telling us you don't, you know, want to accept award for anything less than your full quantity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and just one clarification, Sarah and the rest. Once the award is confirmed, you know, that amount, whatever that award is, awarded amount or quantity will be inserted into the contracts itself as a firm number. You're not left hanging to figure out whether it's always going to be in between in years to come.
So it looks like we have some questions through the chat.
There could be one more that have raised your hands, Katie.
Yes. This is Siamak. Would you like to speak?
Hey, yes, this is Siamak. Just a quick confirmation. Are there any requirements for the project to offer the full capacity, or is the project that's partially under another PPA is allowed to bid in with the remainder of the capacity that is available for these auctions? Thank you.
Katie, is that for you? I couldn't quite understand the question. If not, maybe Sima, can you just repeat that question one more time?
Yes, it's basically like tying back to the maximum quantity that we offer. Is it acceptable to submit a project that, just making examples, like that's 200 megawatt solar project that's under a PPA for 100 megawatts? Is it allowed for the project to bid in the remainder 100 megawatts into this process?
I see. I think I understand what you're saying. The awards under this contract for projects selected through the RFP, and under the contract, we must have first rights to your RECs, so that when you commit to the number of RECs, those must be the first RECs that are issued for that vintage coming out from your project to the contracts that are being awarded here. It cannot be subject to any other contracts or arrangements that you have, And any excess RECs from the contracts that we award, it's sort of free for you to use elsewhere. Does it answer your question, Simo? Do you have a follow-up question to that?
I think it does, but sort of like partially. I understand that like the sort of like the right of first for the first right for the RECs, but in case of like with like all the committed quantities, the like if the project can meet the sort of like the total annual quantity, the minimum quantity, and also with those like a shortfall years doesn't trigger those. Is there still other language that prohibits a project to partially submit its capacity to this option?
Not sure if I understand the question right, but the main point here, I think, is that if there is a shortfall year, could be any year, and it may not be a event of default situation. But as long as there is a shortfall year, you're not meeting the delivery year requirements, you cannot be selling the RECs elsewhere, if that makes sense. The RECs must come straight into the utility buyer in this case. So only if there are excess RECs in excess of the delivery year requirements, which is really your annual quantity in most of the years, that's what you're free to use however you want.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah.
Let's see, so from Cassandra H, will these slides be posted to the website? Yes, they'll be posted to the draft documents page of the index rec section, along with an audio. From John P, oh, can you give an indication of order of magnitude of the supplier fee? You know, that information is posted from performance on the website. And that might be the best way to take a look. There's an archive page on the website there. Or if you'd like us to sort of dig out some information, if you want to submit that to us by email, and we can take some time to do that, that would work as well. Also, the Part 1 submission requires a map of the project site, what level of detail should be shown. So you definitely need to show the boundary of the project site, and you know, an indication, obviously, of where that site is. And if you submit that map to us and we have clarifying questions, you know, we'll come back to you with a notice to make sure we have the level of detail that we need. And the map, you know, needs to correspond really with site control documentation or the interconnection, you know, related documentation and the address provided as well. It needs to all be consistent. Are there any other questions? We have a question from Juan A. In the Part 1 evaluation, are there any subjective evaluations of the project milestones? For project maturity, nope. You're going to have to either submit that documentation from interconnection, or if that's not available, you'll have to meet the very specific, you know, quantities, the acreage required in the documentation. And you'll need to provide all the documentation. It will be reviewed in full. But no subjective evaluations. Does that answer your question? Okay.
I'm not seeing any other hands raised. Katie, are there others in the chat that you're seeing?
We just got one from Sarah G. If we are working with Ameren or another utility to build a new switchyard, we need to ensure Ameren has a PLA, or is that outside of the scope of our responsibility?
I'm not sure if, Kelly, do you want to answer that question?
Yeah, I think it comes down to whether or not the switchyard is part of the project itself or if it sits outside of the project. And I know that there are also some, there may be something in the, that actually might not have anything to do with it. I think this is something that we can take back and consider and post an FAQ on. This is something that we might want to give more information on, but if you can provide some more information, Sarah, about whether or not that switchyard is part of the project or technically sits outside of the project, that might be helpful.
Mm.
It is part of the project, is what she just wrote in the chat. Mm. Okay, thank you.
And we'll take a look into that and provide an FAQ on that. Maybe we'll just wait one more minute. Anyone have other questions or comments? This is our chance to hear from you. Katie, did we have comments on the rest of the other items that we were soliciting comments on?
I haven't seen anything come through.
Okay, maybe we should ask them on this workshop to see if anyone have questions on that.
We received a comment from Brennan on the coal mines.
That's right.
And that'll be very useful if you could submit that on Wednesday. And then if there was anyone with any feedback on the timing of the requirement for the PLA, if construction has started as of the part one date, or as of the time you submit your part one proposal, as of right now, the PLA would need to have been filed with the IPA and approved. And we're wondering if that's an appropriate timing.
Anyone on this call have any comments on that, on a timing issue? Could you raise your hands if you have anything useful for us to consider? Hearing none, I have one other question for this larger group here on the systems for the monthly generation reporting. We do ask that we have access to your PGM system meter data, as well as the MISO market portal. We're not sure if these are the right systems, but we need an independent check of the generation data from your project. Anyone have any insights as to the systems that we are to use or to get these megawatt hour generation hourly data, if these are not the right systems we have? Does anyone in this workshop have visibility into those systems? Okay, I'm not seeing any hands raised. Katie, do we have any other things in the chat?
No, I think we're at the end of the questions.
Okay, then I think for purposes of this workshop, just a couple of reminders. One, this presentation and the audio again will be posted after today's workshop on the website, on the procurement website. Please look there for a refresh of the information. Comments are due by this Wednesday, February 9th. comments will be posted online, but we will be redacting them, especially when it comes to the contract. But you can also redact them on your own and mark anything that is sensitive or commercially confidential on your end. For those of you who have provided comments verbally to us today, please also send them to us in writing. And if you have any questions on the requirements or process, please do send them to us after today's workshop online to the procurement website. There is a form that you can use to send them to us via email. And with that, on behalf of the Illinois Power Agency, I want to thank you very much for your participation, and we look forward to your continued participation in the upcoming procurement process. You may now disconnect. Thank you very much.